Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I think today's program will be particularly important for those of you who may be suffering from chronic pain. There's reliable evidence that the use of opioid-like medications for chronic non-cancer pain may not be very effective for most patients, and that their use carries significant risk of side effects. Nevertheless, the use of these medications for chronic non-cancer pain is considerable. Our guest today is Dr. Gary Franklin of the University of Washington School of Public Health, and he's written a position statement on this very issue for the American Academy of Neurology. You can reach us today with questions and comments. If you are in Anchorage, our regular number is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Franklin, it's a pleasure to have you join us. Thanks for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, would you mind just telling us a little bit about what your background is, what you're doing at this particular time of your life related to medicine?
Well, I'm a board-certified neurologist, and I've been doing neurology, clinical neurology and academic neurology and public health research since I finished my neurology training many years ago in San Francisco. Right now, I'm a research professor at the University of Washington in the School of Public Health, and the medical director of the Washington State Department of Labor and Industries. In other words, I oversee the quality of health care that all of the injured workers in Washington receive.
You've been, it turns out, somewhat instrumental in understanding this issue of opioid pain relievers for non-cancer pain and their use, overuse, and complications. Could you tell us how you got into this?
Well, in my position overseeing the quality of care for all the injured workers in Washington, I'm heavily involved with a lot of guideline subcommittees and clinicians in the state to try to come up with policies that make sense for, you know, what we should cover and what we don't need to cover, what might be effective to help injured workers heal from mostly musculoskeletal injuries, and what might be harming injured workers. So in 1999, the laws in Washington, along with many other states, became much more permissive in regard to opioid prescribing for chronic pain. And we can talk about that in a little bit about why that happened, but within a 2 or 3 years of that law becoming much more permissive, I began to notice, our staff began to send me cases of injured workers who had come into the system with, you know, basically acute low back sprains or low back pain or knee aches or whatever, and they were dead 3 years later from an accidental overdose of prescription painkillers. And no one in the country had recognized this at the time, and so I wrote up a report and reported the very first such deaths from prescribed opioids, prescribed painkillers, that happened to be in injured workers. But so this was the first report in the country on these deaths, and it was, you know, it rang some alarm bells.
So let's now define some terms. I want to make sure readers or listeners don't get misinformation and understand very clearly what the topics of discussion are today. So when we talk about opioids, what are we talking about? And give us some names of products that our listeners may be aware of.
Well, we're talking about mostly things like OxyContin, oxycodone, Vicodin, and combinations of drugs like oxycodone and Tylenol, combination drugs, longer-acting, more drugs that are much more powerful, like fentanyl, that is a patch or that you put under in your mouth, and other drugs like extended-release opioids, which are much more powerful and lead to higher drug levels in your system. So there's a whole a category of these drugs. They are mostly Schedule II drugs. The DEA schedules these drugs into the classes that are most likely to be dangerous. Schedule II is the most dangerous class of opioids. Schedule III is less dangerous, and Schedule IV is less dangerous than that. So almost all opioids now, and Vicodin is being rescheduled into Schedule II. So basically, most opioids that are being used for chronic pain right now will be Schedule II opioids, or the drugs that are that people can become dependent and addicted to, that can be very dangerous.
And when we talk about, I was careful in my introduction to talk about the use of these products for chronic non-cancer pain. What are we talking about then when we talk about non-cancer pain, and why do we separate the two?
Well, for a long time, people shied away from opioids altogether because of the addiction risks. But then, some pain leaders recognized that opioids could be helpful in people at the end of their life to keep them comfortable, and that makes complete sense. So if you're if you're in hospice care and you have severe pain, or if you have cancer pain and you don't have long to live, it doesn't really matter what it takes, to keep you comfortable. But if you have a condition like low back pain or shoulder pain or carpal tunnel syndrome or anything like that, that you might live with off and on for years, then you have to take into account what is the benefit of taking opioids versus what are the risks of taking these drugs long term. So we are mostly talking about the problems, the risk-benefit ratio for chronic non-cancer pain, such as chronic low back pain, chronic headaches, arthritis pain, and all manner of chronic pain.
Okay. And perhaps...
And I should say that when we define chronic pain, we mean pain that has been there for more than 3 months.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that was what I was going to get at. What's the difference between acute and chronic? So 3 months is kind of a standard cutoff for that term.
Correct.
All right. So one more question. How do these pain medicines work? What do we know about the mechanism with which they have their effects?
Well, you have receptors in your brain. A lot of people have heard of endorphin receptors those are the pain receptors in certain parts of your brain, and actually they're in the same parts of your brain that nicotine receptors are. So the reward systems in the brain are the systems that these endorphin receptors work at. And so you have your own endorphins that your own body makes that is in response to pain. And then most of the drugs that are used are synthesized to be like well-known opioids like heroin. So the molecules that are used, synthesized drugs, the molecules that are synthesized are very, very similar to heroin, except for a few atoms difference in their structure. So these are potent drugs that are meant to, act on the same receptors that your own endorphin acts on.
Mm-hmm. And they are particularly good at blocking pain, at least in the acute phase.
Well, there's no more powerful medicine to block pain.
Okay.
So if you are, if you fracture your leg and you have a unbelievable pain, nothing will make that pain better than an opioid painkiller. And the standard of care for treating severe acute pain is opioids. The standard of care for treating surgical pain, at least for a few days, is mm-hmm. opioids. So the problem is not the use of for a day or two or three mm-hmm. for these kinds of severe acute pains. The problem is in more long-term treatment of pain.
Okay. And quickly, perhaps, let's discuss side effects, and then I want to ask how we got to this position statement and what we learned about the numbers of people having side effects.
Thank you. I think if it's okay with you, before we get to the side effects, I'd like to finish the whether it's effective side.
Good.
So we talked about you know, that it's a standard of care for acute pain.
Right.
But the evidence on whether opioid painkillers are actually effective in improving chronic pain longer term, like, say, longer than 6 weeks or longer than 3 months, is non-existent. There is no evidence that opioids actually help improve, say, pain and your ability to do more every day after more than, the acute phase. So that's the on the effectiveness side, if you're talking about the risk-effectiveness profile, the balance,
right.
On the effectiveness side, the evidence is actually very slim that they actually help. And there's, you know, there's a lot of stated reasons for that. So on the other side, on the adverse effect side, that is a huge the evidence for harms is huge. So if you just ask the simple question, what is the balance? The evidence on effectiveness is very slim. The evidence on harms is great. So that is the sort of the summary statement.
So let me clarify this in my own mind and maybe for listeners. I've often stated on the program a number of times that it's really important to ask yourself with any treatment, what's the risk of treatment versus the risk of not treatment? And that's one of the issues. And then you have to ask yourself, is the treatment effective? And then you're weighing those risk benefits. So what I hear you saying is that in the acute pain situation,
severe acute pain,
the risk benefit ratio is these are effective, and the risk benefit ratio is worth it if we need them in the in the long term. In chronic pain, that pain greater than 3 months, particularly non-cancer pain, then the side effect ratio is increased. And when we really look at it, as intuitive as it may be that it should still be working, there's very little evidence that opioid medications have an effect on chronic pain.
They in the longer term, the best available evidence is that they help pain very modestly, but not enough to actually help you do more every day.
Yeah. So why would that be? Why would it work in the acute phase, but perhaps lack effectiveness or less effectiveness over time?
Well, I think like a lot of drugs, the receptors that we talked about earlier that are for the endorphins, your own body's painkillers, the more you stimulate these receptors, the less likely they are to respond properly. Mm-hmm. So overwhelming those receptors will lead to things like tolerance, that you will need more and more and more of the opioid for no more effect, for no more no better effect. So, for example, if you're on 40 milligrams a day, morphine equivalents, today and your pain level is a 7, it is highly likely that your pain level, if that dose ramps up because of tolerance, the dose might ramp up to 100 milligrams a day or much higher than that, that your pain level at that point is probably going to be about the same, or it could be worse, mm-hmm. because opioids can cause hyperalgesia, their own brand of increased pain. So as you're increasing the dose, you're not improving the patient's outcome or their ability to do more every day, but you are dramatically making the risk of severe harm worse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We're going to perhaps, if we have time, come back to this issue of other potential reasons why I think they may not be as effective, which is very interesting. But what we do know is that we have no consistent, solid, good evidence that continuing to use long-term pain medicines for most people is worthwhile. It's not that there may not be some. Is that fair to say, some people that may continue to benefit?
Well, you know, a lot of pain experts say that, but they can't tell you who they are.
Okay. All right.
And until we have more evidence about who that might be best in, but honestly, you probably shouldn't be using, because of that risk-benefit imbalance,
right.
You probably shouldn't be using opioids at all for certain conditions that are chronic pain conditions that I would designate as being mostly mild to moderate pain most of the time.
Okay.
So, for example, nonspecific low back pain or chronic headaches or fibromyalgia, I know that, you know, people with severe headaches, you know, when they have that severe headache, it seems like the worst pain in the world. But honestly, and if you took an opioid for a severe migraine, that's not the best medication for migraine. The American Academy of Neurology, you know, basically says you should be using migraine medicines, not pain medication for migraine. So, you know, for most of the kinds of pain that people have that cause chronic pain, you probably shouldn't be using opioids at all. And what about things like, you know, severe destructive arthritis, you know, with like rheumatoid arthritis, or say somebody, you know, a kid with sickle cell anemia that has a sickle crisis. These are all terrible pains. And if, you know, if you wanted to use some opioid very briefly or intermittently in cases like that, that would probably be a better thing to do than to use opioids around the clock.
Okay. All right. Let me remind listeners real quickly, you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guest today is Dr. Gary Franklin. Dr. Franklin has written a position statement on the use of opioid medications for chronic non-cancer pain for the Academy of Neurology. That's really our topic today, the chronic use of opioid-like medications for non-cancer pain. If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. So bring us up to the factors that led to the Academy of Neurology asking you to write a position statement on this issue.
Well, the American Academy of Neurology, some of their leaders, and I've been active in that academy for many years. I helped lead their evidence-based guideline practice parameter development a few years ago. They knew that I had experience in Washington State, that I had written up these deaths, and that I had experience in the policy arena of state policy to address the emerging epidemic of opioid deaths and opioid hospitalizations and severe problems from opioids, which we haven't really talked about yet. I mean, there have been over 100,000 deaths in the country from prescribed opioids in the past 10 or 15 years. 58,000 people died in Vietnam. So that puts in perspective what the severe consequences have been from the use of opioids chronically for conditions that they don't seem to be helping very much.
How did we? So you had mentioned earlier that the guidelines in the late 90s had suggested that we should liberalize the use of opioids for chronic pain. Do you want to talk about that issue? How did the guidelines get there? And then in retrospect, what happened?
Well, so, you know, I've become fond of saying that this is the worst man-made epidemic in history. And when I say man-made epidemic, I mean made by organized medicine, by drug companies, and by others who led us down a garden path back in the late 1990s. What happened was that some pain leaders, very prominent pain leaders, clinical and academic pain leaders, because of their good experience using opioids for cancer pain, thoughtfully said, well, why couldn't we comfort people in chronic pain? You know, we've been effective in using it for cancer pain. And they started teaching, but the problem is that, number one, their experience with this was very limited to, say, small case series in their offices. There weren't any randomized trials whether this worked or not, but also they had zero experience with the ill effects, which, of course, at that time hadn't quite started because the epidemic of dramatically increasing doses hadn't started. And the reason that happened was they taught that there is no ceiling on dose. They taught that you can use any amount of opioid, and the way to treat tolerance is to keep increasing the dose. And remember that most people who take these drugs become tolerant. They need more and more as time goes on to maintain the same effect. And so what happened after the late 90s when this all happened, the way this was done was that some of these folks and their surrogates lobbied states to change the state laws because almost all healthcare is regulated at the state level. So they were smart. and they had a lot of state laws changed to make the prescribing of opioids completely permissive. So, for example, in Washington state, when those laws changed, the language that was put in our law said things like, no doctor shall be sanctioned for any amount of opioid written. In other words, you could be handing out bags of opioids to people, and the state medical board wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So it was those kinds of teachings based on no science, but based on this, these are their opinions, and on drug company marketing. This led doctors to, especially primary care doctors, to think, well, if the patient had a level of 7 out of 10 of pain last month, and now they're still 7 out of 10 or 8 out of 10, I'm going to increase their opioids. Mm-hmm. And so the doses went through the roof. The amount prescribed of the strongest opioids went through the roof, and people started to die. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I want to say is that the death and the overdose hospitalizations, that's only the tip of the iceberg. The main problem has become that if you're on these painkillers for even 3 months, the likelihood of your being able to ever get off, say in 5 years, is less than 50%. That if you start taking these drugs and you don't need to take them for very long, you will develop at least dependence. The definition of that is that if you try to stop them, you'll have withdrawal effects or addiction, or in the new terminology for the DSM-5, substance use disorder. And addiction, people that are addicted, they really, it is very, very hard to ever stop the opioids in someone who's developed addiction. And so the other thing they taught back in the late 90s was that, another false teaching was that less than 1% of people who are on opioids chronically become addicted. In fact, they even coined a new term back then called pseudo-addiction. So this was a surrogate, mm-hmm. a doctor surrogate of one of the drug companies who published a paper and said, your patients might look addicted, but actually what they really need is more opioids. And they coined the term pseudo-addiction. So, the messages back then were based on no science, but a lot of marketing and false teachings. And if you don't understand all of that, it's very hard for a state to reverse this epidemic.
Right. I'm a pediatrician, and I don't do pain. I don't use these kinds of medications at all. But I do remember back in the 90s, roughly, best that I can serve, is there was a lot of evidence, or there was, evidence is not the right word, there was a lot of use, and it seemed very appropriate for end-of-life care to help people be comfortable. I remember my father-in-law dying of significant pain with bowel cancer that had metastasized to his bones, and it was very helpful to control his pain. And it seems to me at that same time there was a lot of legal concern about the use of those medications for any purpose, and so we were kind of liberalizing it, making it easier to use it for cancer pain, and then what I'm hearing you say, along with that, there was misinformation in retrospect that came out about its use for non-cancer pain, and this is how this kind of got started. I'm not maybe saying it exactly right, but looking at it from a non-medical person, that's kind of how we got there. And is that somewhat right?
I think that's essentially correct. The thing is that those laws that passed, the Intractable Pain Act,
right.
They did not address specifically, they were addressing chronic pain.
Okay.
They weren't addressing end-of-life or cancer pain. Now, if they wanted to say, let's provide a safe haven mm-hmm. for doctors to be able to use these opioids when they need to, mm-hmm. like for severe acute pain or for end-of-life care or for terminal or cancer pain, let's give them a safe haven for that, right. So that they're not discouraged from doing mm-hmm. that. They should be doing more of that. Mm-hmm. But the language that I'm talking about, the thing about no doctor shall be sanctioned for any amount of opioid written, that was specifically for cancer pain. I mean, for non-cancer pain,
okay.
For musculoskeletal pain and things like that. And there are still many states and the Federation of State Medical Boards which still have statements like that material.
Okay. All right. To whom was the position paper intended? When the Academy addressed or came to you, did you have an audience in mind in particular?
Well, of course, the audience being the American Academy of Neurology was, you know, for the 15,000 or so international and you know, U.S. neurologists that belong mm-hmm. to the American Academy of Neurology. But this thing, you know, really took off, and because, you know, it was not, although it was written with a few neurological points in mind, it was written to a general audience. Okay. And so it is, and this was the first professional society. When I said, you know, before, this is the worst man-made epidemic caused by modern medicine, this was the first specialty society in modern medicine to take a stand that this might not be worth it for most patients with chronic pain.
And I think it might be worthwhile also, before we take a break, to attempt to validate your findings as well. I know the CDC has looked at this issue as well. So would you maybe ferret out a little bit of more information about the epidemiology of this problem?
Well, I mean, the death rate, you mean as far as the harms?
Yeah, yeah. And who else has looked at the same data?
I was the first one to report the deaths, but the CDC has made a major emphasis of trying to reverse this epidemic of morbidity and mortality from prescription painkillers. And they not only have agreed with a lot of the things that we have previously written, such as having a dosing threshold, having a warning level dose, and having doctors do best practices. If they're going to prescribe opioids, they should at least be doing best practices, which most doctors are not doing currently. We can talk about that when we get back. But the CDC is, in fact, working on new guidelines, which should be ready by later this year.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and take our break. We're going to take about 1 minute, and then we'll be back to continue this discussion. I want to remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1, and you have to spell that out, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. After this very short break, we'll continue our discussion on the treatment of chronic non-cancer pain with opioid medications with our guest, Dr. Gary Franklin of the University of Washington School of Public Health. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Gary Franklin of the University of Washington School of Public Health. We're discussing the effectiveness and risks of opioid medications for chronic non-cancer pain. And in fact, we found that there's very little evidence, really good evidence. I've often said, or I think, there's a lot of evidence out there. Really good evidence is a different issue and really important in making medical decisions. But there's a lack of really good evidence for effectiveness, and there is significant evidence of risk of opioid-like medications for chronic non-cancer pain. If you have questions, you can reach us at line1@alaskapublic.org by email. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Remember, if you'd like to have someone listen to this program again, it does repeat tonight between 9 and 10. It's a taped recording on 91.1, but we won't be here to answer questions. Also, if you go to alaskapublic.org, you can find the Line 1 link, and you can find our archives, which would include this program and others that we've had in the last couple of years, if someone wants to listen to the program again. Let's take a phone call to get started, Dr. Franklin. Claire, you're on Line 1.
Oh, hello. Hi, yeah. I'm here.
Yeah, what can we do for you?
I just wanted to talk about, I'm an attorney here in Alaska, and I've been doing criminal law for more than 20 years. And I totally agree with your guest, 100%. But has he analyzed what this over-prescribing of pain pills has done to crime in this country? I guess I'm not explaining this that well,
How does
every day, if you go to a courthouse, I mean, these criminal defendants, they are all hooked on prescription pain pills, opiates, and then they move on to heroin, or they move back and forth, and it is just, you know, causing rampant crime. It's ruining people's lives, and I think doctors are naive. Mm-hmm. If they would run a little criminal background check on their patients before they prescribed, they would see, oh, wait, this person might be scamming me. This person actually has a bunch of drug convictions on their record.
Right. All right. Good question. Dr. Franklin?
Well, there's a couple of things around that. I don't, I haven't been looking too much at the crime statistics, but I do know that probably about half of new heroin initiates, you know, people who start on heroin right now today, started on prescription opioids. And because heroin is cheaper than oxycodone, for example. So if you look at the CDC statistics, in some states, the rate of death from prescribed opioids is going down, but the rate of death from heroin is going up, and that's because of this shift over. But the problem was still originally the prescribing of the opioids. And I think I would want to be a little bit careful here, because one of the things that some of the same forces that caused this problem, 20 years ago, love to talk about this primarily as the problem is in the patient. You know, it's a patient abuse problem. I think that if anything has happened, it has been that people have become dependent or addicted on prescribed opioids, unbeknownst to them in the beginning of their pain episode. And perhaps then, when they ended up using heroin or ended up on the street, maybe they took to crime. But I just want to disabuse the fact that we're talking about this is a horrible patient problem. It's really a bad prescribing problem.
Right. It's a bad prescribing problem, but I've seen it go the other way. I see younger defendants, then they move, and they're using street drugs, and then they move into middle age, and it's too hard to get the street drugs. So then they find an overly caring physician who's willing to prescribe it. So they're seeking out pain meds in middle age. You know, they don't need them. They're just chronic drug addicts, and they want a high. And,
absolutely.
And then these physicians
So, for example, we're working on a new guideline.
Who they're handing the drugs to.
Right. We're working on a new guideline down here in Washington.
And they believe people.
Sorry?
I think physicians are too trusting and caring, and they're too busy. And if somebody tells them, I've got chronic pain, they believe them. I mean,
right.
And they're just passing them out like candy. I've seen this for, 20 years now, 15 anyway.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Our new guidelines down here in Washington basically will say that if you have somebody who has a history, if they have current substance use disorder from any substance, you shouldn't use opioids at all, unless it's acute pain. Do not use opioids chronically in people with substance use disorder. Do not use opioids in people that had opioid use disorder in the past. So if you were a heroin abuser and you come in with a low back injury, do not use opioids in that patient. So you're bringing up a tremendous point of, some of these patients have, really pretty bad histories of substance abuse. Those are the worst possible patients to give prescribed opioids to.
And the physicians don't do a background check. They're just too trusting, I think.
Yeah, well, they don't even check the state prescription monitoring program. You know, all states now have a prescription monitoring program where a doctor should be checking the computer for all the other sources of opioids the patient might be getting. And so before a doctor writes a first prescription, whether it's in their office or in an emergency department or an urgent care center, they should be checking the prescription monitoring program to see what other opioids or controlled substances the patient's been getting and from whom. That would be a best practice.
I think
practice.
In Alaska, we don't have that quite yet.
I think the pharmacies can do it. I'm not sure the physicians, but I don't want to
I think we're not there yet. I think there's legislation pending, and we're not there. I personally know someone who goes to four different pharmacies to get it.
Hmm. Yeah, I should have checked that before I came on. I just don't know what the status is of the PDMP, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, but I know that 48 states have it.
Right. It's just a horrible problem that I've seen up close for 20 years. It's horrible. You know.
Well, thank you for raising the crime issue. It's something that we will look into down here.
Yeah, I think there should be training between criminal justice and physicians so that the physicians' eyes can be open to what problems they're causing by prescribing this.
Well, from a public health standpoint, you want to try to prevent the problem, of course. And it's the that's what we're focusing on. Don't use opioids for chronic low back pain. Don't use opioids for chronic headaches. Don't use opioids for fibromyalgia. You know, you're going to, A, you might kill the person. B, they're very likely to get dependent or addicted. Or C, you know, if any of those things happen, they could become a street user of heroin or a criminal.
Mm-hmm. And it goes the other way, too.
Yeah, heroin. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, sure.
Dr. Franklin, just the way my mind works is I'm trying to think that we need to put this in some perspective. And the way I would try to do this is this issue appears to have its origins in the late 90s. So it's not that old. And then it got out of hand and now it's been recognized. And you've written a position paper for the Academy of Neurology. And in that, there is also some very good table that I have in front of me, and I hope you do too, that just talks about what prescribers can do to use opioids if they're needed for chronic non-cancer pain. You want to go through that list? It may help Claire, who just called, recognize that there's an effort trying to be made to control some of the problems that have originated from this
right.
change.
Thank you. So the first thing in that paper is don't use opioids for chronic pain. If it's things like nonspecific low back pain, chronic headaches, or fibromyalgia, things that are primarily, mild to moderate pain, not an acute fracture or a severe pain like cancer pain. But if you have a patient like with destructive arthritis that you feel like you need to use it, doctors have patients already on high doses, patients that are already on chronic opioids on high doses. So it's not too late to do these things. Number one, you should have an opioid treatment agreement, which is a signed document that where the doctor and the patient are both signing a sheet saying, these are our mutual responsibilities. Here's what I'll do for you. Here's what you need to do as your responsibility. Number two, as I mentioned earlier, you need to screen for prior or current substance abuse or misuse. That would include from alcohol, from illicit drugs, heavy tobacco use, or even people that have cannabis use disorder by the new DSM-5. Number three, screen for depression. Patients that have significant mental health issues that are on opioids are much more likely to have an adverse event. A prudent use of random urine drug screening, and this is for the doctor to check to see whether the patient is taking the things that they're giving them and to make sure they're not taking stuff they're not giving them. Do not use, and this is probably the biggest thing on the list, do not use concomitant sedative hypnotic sleeping pills or benzodiazepines like Valium. For some reason, the concomitant use of these drugs with opioids dramatically increases the risk for an overdose event because the way you die from an overdose event is you go to sleep and you stop breathing. That's what opioids do, and these drugs contribute to that. The doctor should track pain and function at every visit, so that they can recognize whether tolerance is developing and to track whether the drug is effective in you and your in your patient. Number the next one is to track the daily morphine equivalent dose using a handy calculator that is present online or that you can put as an app on your phone. So if you have in your chart at every visit the dose and the level of pain and function, you know where you're at every single visit. Seek help. This is, again, to the doctor. If the morphine equivalent dose reaches 80 to 120 milligrams and pain and function have not substantially improved, you should be asking for help at that point from a pain specialist. And then finally, check the state prescription drug monitoring program to monitor all sources of controlled substances and which controlled substances the patient is on.
Okay. There is a email that I've gotten that is really addressing, okay, so what do I do? Basically, it's an individual who says, I have chronic pain. What do we do about this if the over-the-counter medications are not being effective? How do I approach this?
So I mean, it's a totally legitimate question, and most patients who come to the doctor with pain have totally legitimate pain, and it is an extremely important question to be able to answer from a doctor's standpoint. And the kinds of things that are very helpful for pain, first of all, there are pharmacological alternatives, as you've mentioned, Tylenol and non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Some patients that have chronic pain and they also happen to have some insomnia or sleeplessness may have underlying depression, and tricyclic antidepressants can be extremely helpful in those patients, even though they're not pain pills. And then there are all manner of alternative treatments that have been proven to be useful, such as cognitive behavioral therapy for back problems. Chiropractic can be extremely effective. We have found so in our studies. And graded exercise. It's very important to increase your level of activity, because the more you can do and the less opioid you take, the better off you're going to be. So if you are on chronic opioids and you're still not doing well, you should consider strongly tapering them off and getting into a reactivation program. But this question of, what can doctors do for my pain, that is a crucial question. It's also really important that payers, insurance companies, pay for these alternatives to opioids. And the last thing I'll mention is that, there aren't that many pain clinics around, and insurers need to be incentivizing multidisciplinary pain treatment centers to help people with severe chronic pain.
A listener has sent in by email a link, which we will go ahead and put on with other links that we have to information on this program on our website, to the Alaska Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which apparently does exist. And we'll have that link added up probably by the time the program's over, if I'm getting the right okay from my engineers today.
Yeah, well, thank you for sending that in. It's very, very important. It would be a best practice for any doctor to check that program before prescribing any opioids and while prescribing opioids in the acute, subacute, and chronic phases.
We also have an email from a counselor. I think she may have also been holding online and couldn't hold anymore, that a licensed professional counselor runs a group for people with chronic pain, and she says their experience has been that counseling is an effective supplement to pain management, regardless of whether or not the patient is using opioids. So it gets to the issue, in my mind, is that there's a distinct difference between acute pain and chronic pain. We think of it as the same thing. And in preparation for the program, I was listening to a primary care physician in England talk to a pain management expert in England, and she made the point that for many people with chronic pain, the initial pain tissue injury, as she put it, has resolved. And so that the whole issue of what's causing chronic pain may be really different than acute pain. Would you comment on that possibility?
Yeah, I think there's a I think that's a a very important point. Most there's more increasing evidence using things like functional neuroimaging, like functional MRI or PET scanning, that and the evidence is increasing that for a few weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks or whatever, the initially damaged tissue is where the pain is mostly coming from. But as the person transitions to chronic pain, say after 3 months of pain, there's good evidence that it's really the brain that's reacting at that point, and it's the brain that is helping to somehow sustain the chronic pain, not the originally injured part. So the kinds of things we have classically done for pain chronically have been to continue to do things like inject the injured area or operate on the injured area, even after years of chronic pain. But I think it's a mistake to think that it is really that originally injured part that is the biggest problem here. It is probably the brain adapting to this to the pain that is the biggest problem, and treating the brain more effectively, such as with cognitive behavioral therapy, is probably the way to go.
Mm-hmm. Now I've got this thought in my mind that we've got listeners out there who, let's say they're buying in. We've learned some better science. We've got better evidence. They're on long-term pain management. They may be seeing pain specialists. They may be seeing primary care physicians. What should they be doing at this particular time? What's your advice to them?
Well, the main thing is, how are they doing? If they are on opioids and they are substantially better and functioning well in life, that's fine, as long as they're not on extremely high doses. But if you're on over 120 milligrams a day, if you add up all the things you're taking, then you are at, substantially increased risk of having an opioid overdose, especially if you take sleeping pills or sedatives with that, or especially if you drink with that. So I would, pay attention to the dose. If you are not doing well on your opioids, no matter how much you're taking, then you might not, and they might want to talk to your doctor about seriously tapering the opioids off and trying alternative pathways, such as a cognitive behavioral therapy, pain clinic, graded exercise, swimming programs, anything to reactivate and re-enter life as an active, productive person.
I do believe also, I don't have your statement in front of me, but there are, I think you mentioned that there are protocols for weaning off of these medications, those should be available to physicians who are needing to do this.
Right. There aren't a lot of those protocols, but if you look on the Washington Agency Medical Directors, if you just Google Washington Agency Medical Directors Group, then the Agency Medical Directors Group opioid guideline will come up. And that will have specific, by June, that will have specific guidance in it for tapering. But right now, if you Google Washington Workers' Compensation Opioid Guidelines, our guidelines from 2013 have very specific tapering guidance for people that meet a case definition for needing to be tapered, such as if they have an opioid overdose event. We found in a recent study that a lot of people that had overdose events, that is, they could have died, are still getting their opioids afterwards. And part of that is that their doctor may not have known that that happened. So it's very, very important to bring this to your doctor's attention if you have a severe problem like that.
Let's go back to, just briefly, you mentioned depression. I still think there's a need for at least the public, physicians and healthcare providers, this is not necessarily to accept the fact that depression is an extremely common problem, and certainly pain by itself could lead to depression, and that maybe depression, emotions are part of the driving factor in the perception of chronic pain. I'm trying to choose my words carefully. I'm not an expert in this area. Can you comment on what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah, absolutely. I took care of a lot of chronic headache patients when I was in practice some years ago, and I never used opioids, but I always asked a patient. A lot of people have, you know, headaches day in and day out. They're often chronic tension headaches. So alternative means of treating those headaches through stress management and biofeedback is one approach to recognize when the headaches come on and to help the patient control them. But many of those patients, I always ask the patient, do you get to sleep? Do you stay asleep? Some people that have trouble getting to sleep have a lot of anxiety. But if the problem is that you can get to sleep but then wake up all night long and can't sleep through the night, that is often associated with depression. And using relatively small doses of a tricyclic antidepressant or another kind of antidepressant in those patients, just as an empiric way of treating the chronic pain, often helps very much.
We are about 5 or 6 minutes before the end of the program, and I think what I'd like to do, Dr. Franklin, is the questions that I have, I've completed. I'd like to go over again what's happened here, if you don't mind summarizing again the recommendations. What are we finding is the issue and the suggestions for being careful for listeners and what physicians and patients should be doing together to help solve this problem?
Well, first of all, the state, every state needs to take a look at its policies. And if they still have policies in place that reflect the extremely permissive language from the late 1990s, that language needs to be repealed. And more specific language to help doctors with what best practices they should be doing should be put into place. There, every guideline in the world now agrees on what those best practices are, especially including tracking pain and function and tracking the dosage. And if your patient's doses are escalating, it means that they're developing tolerance and very well may be developing substance opioid use disorder or addiction. If the patient is on opioids for 3 months, they will very likely not be able to come off of opioids. And so patients and doctors need to realize that if you use opioids for chronic pain, you are very likely to cause dependence and or addiction from which the patient may never recover. The question is whether that is worth it in patients with chronic pain. In the view of the American Academy of Neurology, the evidence on effectiveness is not strong enough to overcome the evidence of harm. And so you probably should not be using opioids at all as chronic treatment every day in people with folks with nonspecific low back pain, headaches, and fibromyalgia. And we need to all come together here to decide what will help people with chronic pain. What should insurance companies be paying for? And I believe that focusing on the alternative treatments, the alternatives to opioids, and much more coordination within communities is what will help patients. They need our help, and we need to figure out how to give them that help.
One last question that comes to mind is there's always going to be disagreement about issues, particularly issues like this. What are the primary arguments against, if any, of the suggestions being made by policy statements and guidelines such as you're promulgating?
Well, if the people that are making those statements were the same ones that were selling us a bill of goods back in 1999, then I would say they have no credibility. Okay. Second thing is that if there are doctors that are saying that, I would look on Dollars for Docs, a ProPublica website, to see whether whether and how much money they are taking from drug companies. Also, CMS has a new payment website where you can check to see what all doctors are receiving from drug and device manufacturers to see if there's any conflict of interest between your doctor and then sort of having a financial or a non-financial conflict of interest in using these medications. I don't think anybody disagrees that there is no evidence that these drugs do not work chronically. There's no disagreement about that. And so if people are still yelling and screaming in the wilderness about, this kind of position paper or this kind of these statements, I really believe that in 5 or 10 years, hardly any of these drugs will be used for chronic pain.
And as I've implied also, this is not just a United States problem. We know England is addressing the same issue. So I'm assuming that throughout much of the developed world, we're seeing the same kinds of problems?
Well, not to nearly the same extent. We're seeing it in Australia and Canada, not nearly as much in Europe, because 90% of the opioids written in the entire world are written in the U.S.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I remember reading that. And the other thing is, who are the primary prescribers of opioids, like medications, for pain in the United States?
It is primarily primary care doctors.
Yeah, so they're not pain specialists, per se.
Primarily not pain specialists, unless you have one of the sort of Florida-type pain clinics, right, where you're handing stuff out like in bags. Other than that, it's mostly primary care people. People right. under 25, it's mostly dentists.
Yeah. All right. Dr. Franklin, thanks so much. I think this is probably one of the more important programs I've done in the almost 20 years I've been doing this. I appreciate the recognition of the problem and the willingness to go the extra mile to get the information out to everybody and then begin to act on it in a national format. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's a great service to your citizens.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
If you want to continue this conversation, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website at alaskapublic.org, where you will also find the Line 1 archives that I mentioned earlier. Knowledge about interventional opportunities are really exploding in the field of medical genetics. And to help provide our listeners with some of this knowledge, and perhaps more importantly, to help them find out how to get more information, on the next Line 1, we're going to talk with Anchorage Certified Genetic Counselor Anki Kelly. So why not tune into your health and learn more next Monday, January 19th at 2 p.m. We repeat the same evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA. As a reminder, Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson is now our web editor and audio engineer of today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.